from 90.5 WESA. This is a special edition of The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Donald Trump is sworn in today as the 45th president of the United States. Following one of the most divisive elections, how can the country come together?
This president has a tendency, when you disagree with him, to attack you personally. I think the American people want us to work together. And if we're going to work together, respect needs to be a two-way street.
The inauguration, a cause for celebration for many and dismay for others.
Instead of being jaded or upset or fearful, which I am, I'm going to think about ways that I can work harder in my community to do more things that are going to display the type of outreach that I would like to see a president display.
We'll hear from elected leaders, reporters on the scene, Trump supporters and protesters, plus a panel of experts in our studio. The Confluence follows this news update. It's the special Inauguration Day edition of The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During this hour, we'll be visiting with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, Democratic Congressman Mike Doyle, Marcel Groen, Chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. We'll also hear from WESA reporters in Washington, Donald Trump supporters from Western Pennsylvania, participants in Saturday's Women's March, student journalists from Point Park covering the inauguration, the director of the Franklin Regional High School Band taking part in the parade, and the interim D.C. Metro Police Chief talking about security and dealing with protesters. And to tie it all together, we are joined in studio by a panel of guests. Donald Gilliland is digital editor for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Donald.
Thank you.
Dana Brown, executive director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University. Welcome, Dana.
Good morning.
And Justin DePlato, assistant professor of political science at Robert Morris University. Welcome, Justin.
Good morning.
So let's get right to our first guest. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto traveled to Washington this week, but not for the inauguration, but rather to attend the U.S. Conference of Mayors winter meeting. Mayor, you and I spoke early last week, and you expressed some wariness about what the relationship might be with the Trump administration compared to the Obama administration. Anything during your meetings this week with your colleagues that caused you to change that perception?
Well, Kevin, unfortunately, no. Talking with some of the mayors who have been around for quite a while, it was a unique winter meeting. Usually the winter meetings include meetings with secretaries or secretary nominees. There's a lot of panel discussions about what to expect in the next 100 days, the next year, the next 4 years on grants for transportation, on programming for HUD, on just the different programs that cities rely upon. But this one, the only real conversation we had with the administration was a speech that was given by Vice President-elect Pence.
And
so I would say there's a lot of indecisiveness right now on what the direction of the nation will be on the actual administration.
Did you get to question Mr. Pence?
No. No, it was during the plenary session, during a luncheon. The breakouts with different members of congressional staff, including chiefs of staffs for Senate leaders, I'd say that the most talked about issues were issues that would be important to cities, but maybe most people don't think about, like, will municipal bonds remain tax exempt? Which, if they aren't, in which there's a push in Congress to remove the tax exemption, would mean there's less infrastructure that cities will be able to tend to the idea of this $1 trillion infrastructure investment, which Senator Hatch's chief of staff said is more likely to be $250 billion, not $1 trillion, and looking at private investment to match it through P3s, public-private partnerships, to make up the difference. And then what it would look like is still not even decided. Will it mean that we'll be able to improve our waterways and our roadways, or will it mean that it will be tax credits available to the developers to build retail shopping malls? We don't really know.
Are you concern that although Mr. Trump won Pennsylvania, Secretary Clinton did very well in the Pittsburgh area in Allegheny County. Are you concerned that when it comes to relationship with Pennsylvania, the Trump administration might focus more on areas that he did well and surprisingly well, maybe Johnstown, Erie, and not Philly, and in, of course, in your case, Pittsburgh?
Well, what Mr. Pence said was that it's all about governance and not about politics, realizing that the majority of Americans live in cities and that the Trump administration fared very poorly in cities. It's really, I think, in that sense, it would not benefit the administration to ignore where our GDP is developed. Cities are not only the center of innovation, but they control the American economy. A strong partnership is necessary with the federal government. But I'll tell you this, in conversations with mayors, the idea of going it alone and how do you do that became a big part of the conversation in Washington as well. Who are the partners that you can find locally in order to be able to get your agenda done? Who are the institutions, the foundations, the corporate community? Who are the other people on a local basis to create a regional vision, and then where the federal government would only be looked at as being a supplement to it?
A final question regarding that, Mayor. And that is, yes, looking for new partners or increased participation from other partners. But is it hard to make up, shall we say, that bankroll? So the idea is the vision can come locally, but it still helps to have the big dollars from Washington coming in to help enact that vision.
Well, the big dollars are great, and make no doubt about it. When we went down to Washington last week and were able to bring $253 million back to Pittsburgh to create a global center for autonomous manufacturing, that will be a game changer to this economy. 123 private firms are providing $173 million, met by $80 million in Department of Defense dollars. That will have a spinoff effect that will provide thousands of jobs to this city and region. That's great. That is a game changer. But where it really affects cities with federal dollars isn't on those dollars or the transportation dollars, but on the community development block grant dollars, the money that has been dwindling every year from Congress that basically allows cities to help the most vulnerable and those organizations that serve them. As those dollars start to end, the people who need it the most will suffer. People in the middle will see very little change. You may not see the exit ramp built, or it may be that it will be a few extra years before a bridge is getting repaired. But people who rely upon housing, food, health care will see an immediate effect to their lives.
Mayor Peduto, thanks so much. Appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks, Kevin.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Let's pull in our panel now on this special edition of The Confluence. Again, Donald Gilliland, Tribune Review digital editor, Dana Brown, executive director of Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics, and Justin Toplato, assistant professor of political science at Robert Morris University. Donald, anything that you found interesting what the mayor said there?
Yeah, one of the things that struck me was the urban-rural divide that he touched on a bit. Obviously, Mayor Peduto is concerned, being the mayor of the second largest city in Pennsylvania, that there will be a disruption of federal funds to his constituents. The problem is there's been a disruption of federal funds to wide swaths of rural areas of the United States, that huge red chunk between the two blue coasts. They really haven't seen the economic uptick after 2008 that many of the cities have. And I think the mayor's probably right in being concerned that there's going to be a certain focus in the new administration on trying to direct what funds are available to those red areas, more to the rural than the urban. That's really the key to this election, was that urban-rural split.
Justin?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Donald on that point. I think the administration will focus more widely as opposed to targeted specifically to the urban area. And so many of Trump's supporters are those rural, suburban, country voters. So expect that to happen.
If you don't mind, I'd like to jump in, and I can ask my colleagues here to correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it traditional that actually more federal and state dollars per person, tax revenue, or, you know, tax dollars, that is, go to the rural communities per person as opposed to cities traditionally? So if we know that that is accurate and has been under both Democrat and Republican presidents and also with the state legislature, I think that Mayor Peduto is correct and my colleagues that we might even see it being pushed further to the rural communities. That's where Donald Trump and Mike Pence did well.
I think that's a false analogy to some extent. And the reason for that, I mean, I'm not arguing with the number.
Okay.
It's a matter of apples to apples. The number, what you're referring to is total federal spending per capita, urban versus rural. And how that figures out is it includes federal spending for roads, mm-hmm. All of that sort of infrastructure stuff in very sparsely populated areas. Yes, absolutely, you get a greater spending. What Mayor Peduto is most concerned about are things like community development block grants, not the infrastructure so much. And I think that that discretionary spending is where you're going to see an urban-rural split. And I think mayors of cities are legitimately concerned that what little is coming out of the federal government may actually decrease.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more question to you. Donald, you mentioned the word split. Has the split always been there, or is there a perception that there's going to be a split widening, or the split is now going to be bridged? Anybody?
The split has always been there. It ebbed. The tension, I think, intensifies and relaxes periodically over time, but it has been a split for as long as this country has been in existence. I mean, it's the fundamental split that you had back with Jefferson and the agriculturists. I mean, this has been a tension in the United States since the founding of the country, but it has become particularly acute and in some ways has flipped in the modern era where poverty in rural areas is actually much more prevalent than back in your colonial days when being in the rural area oftentimes meant you were actually rich because you owned land.
Right, and I would agree with that. I mean, Trump's strategy was to really expose that divide that naturally is already there. It may not have been purposeful. In other words, he sort of stumbled into it, but he certainly exploited what was already there, sort of a working class struggle and a rural-urban divide that is really manifesting more now because of globalization, more now because of polarization and partisanship and ideology between the left and the right.
All right, we're going to have our panel throughout this hour. But right now we want to check in with a Pittsburgh area congressman. At least four of the five Pennsylvania Democrats in the U.S. House are not attending the inauguration. Representatives Bob Brady, Dwight Evans, Brendan Boyle, and our guest now, Democratic Congressman Mike Doyle from the Pittsburgh area. Welcome, Congressman. Congressman, you've served in the House for 22 years. Is it unusual for lawmakers of the opposition party to not attend the inauguration?
I think that a lot of times members may or may not attend inaugurations. I know there were many people when President Obama was elected the second time that didn't attend. You know, this whole week prior to inauguration, the House wasn't in session. So most members are back homes in their districts and they have to decide if they want to fly in, you know, on a Thursday probably to attend the event for a few hours and then get back to their districts if they're not staying for inaugural balls. This one was just a little bit different, I believe, just because this particular president-elect, instead of using this transition period to sort of reach out, especially to his adversaries and sort of bring them into the fold and try to, you know, be a person to unite people, continues to use his Twitter site to attack people. And I think that has caused many members of Congress, especially Democrats, who were particularly upset by what he had to say about John Lewis.
Your colleague, Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, said he didn't see Mr. Trump as a legitimate president. And Mr. Trump responded by saying that Lewis is all talk and no action.
You have to understand, John is somebody who's a dear friend of mine, who I've had in Pittsburgh just this past election. He and I spoke in some black churches. The man is, everyone that knows him, Democrat or Republican, knows that he's a gentle, kind man. He's a true American hero, someone that, you know, put his life on the line for what he believed in. For the president-elect to speak to him on personal terms, as opposed to saying, you know, I'm sorry that the congressman feels that way. We believe we need to start to work together. If he would have approached him in more that kind of a way, I don't think there would have been any bad feelings about it. And if we're going to work together, you know, respect needs to be a two-way street.
Congressman Doyle, you're in the minority party, but you're a veteran congressman. What can you hope to accomplish over the next 2 years in this Congress and the first 2 years of the Trump administration?
President Trump talks about a health care plan where he wants to insure everyone. Well, we're interested to see, you know, what that actually looks like. He claims he wants to do a massive infrastructure bill. Many Democrats want to do that too, but how does that get funded? The president said he doesn't want to touch Social Security and Medicare. Well, he'll find support in the Democratic caucus for ideas like that. So if he's willing to, in a true bipartisan fashion, sit down with Democrats and talk to us, and we have some input, and these proposals come out in a manner that we support, then, you know, there's opportunities for us to work together. We're not looking to cooperate with this administration just for the sake of cooperation.
Congressman Doyle, thanks so much.
Good talking to you.
That's U.S. Representative Mike Doyle of the 14th District. Joining us now is the chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, Marcel Groen. Marcel, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Marcel, it's been 28 years since the Republican presidential nominee captured Pennsylvania. Your party did not win the top two races on the ballot in November for president and U.S. Senate, but did sweep the row office elections for attorney general, auditor general, and treasurer. What does that tell you overall?
Well, it tells us that we need to do better at the top, obviously. But I think that the row office is probably a more indicative of the general state of our party in the state as a whole. So I think we're on a statewide basis, we'll be okay. We have a lot of work to do beyond that, though.
So what does that work entail? Does it entail at the state level, at the county level, local level, at all levels?
At all levels. Look, we have a couple of things that have happened which are hard for us to control, at least right now. The state has been gerrymandered horribly in terms of the redistricting of congressional races and the state legislature. And that's because the state Senate and the Supreme Court at the time and the state House were all controlled by people who, I think, did a poor job from a governing perspective, but did a very good job from a political perspective. Our job, now we have a majority on the Supreme Court. So when redistricting happens in 2 or 3 years, all we want is a fair shake. We don't want districts drawn up for our advantage. We want them drawn up for the people's advantage, which means competition. The best thing for government is competitive races. When you have competitive races, you get better candidates. People are more moderate. They don't take extreme positions. And we have to start working in areas where we are not strong and start getting candidates at the school board level, at the supervisors level, mayors, the races, council races. We have to show people everywhere that we have good people who can run and who can govern well when they get elected.
Well, you mentioned the different levels of government to get stronger at the school board, councils, and mayor's offices. But let me ask you this. Democratic statewide candidates have always had to rely on winning Philly big, Allegheny County big. and then basically holding on. But even some counties that historically went Democratic more often than Republican went red this time. So is it a change in philosophy is needed, a change in approach? Do you just give up on more than, shall we say, 50 counties and hope to improve where you're already strong?
No, we've already started a 67 county strategies. We started that last year. We're going to do it more. And that is by getting people both on the political sense, in other words, building up the committee structure, but more importantly, getting people to run for all of these offices. We are giving up on nothing. I think in the past, one of the mistakes that has been made is that on occasion, not on occasion, but frequently, actually, we've kind of ignored those areas where we didn't think we could do well. Look, if we have an area where we, in a county where we get 30% of the vote, if we can push it up to 35% of the vote in a statewide or national race, that's as important as if you're in a place where you get 50 or 60% and you move it up to 65%. We're going to be very aggressive. We're looking for good candidates, and we're going to get a message out everywhere.
Final question for you. You mentioned gerrymandering, sir, and the difficulties that has posed. Can you accomplish enough in the next several years before the 2020 census and the impact of that sentence on the redistricting, which will happen in the 2022 elections?
Well, let me take a step back first. Gerrymandering, for me, is the worst evil in American politics, because it takes away people's ability to have a legitimate choice. And so I'm committed to stopping that and trying to break it no matter what. Under the circumstances at the present time, we don't have a panacea. It's going to be hard, but we're going to be competitive. We're going to fight. I think this administration has energized our base everywhere. We're going to get, when we have good candidates, and we had some really good candidates in the last congressional races who lost. But I think people saw Christine Hartman, for example, in Lancaster, McClellan in your area. These are really, really good candidates. And I think we can build on that. We will build on it. I come from Montgomery County, and it's not something that you can do overnight. But we turned Montgomery County from red to blue by giving the people good candidates to run. They saw them, and after a while, they warmed up to them, and we started winning. That's what we're going to do everywhere.
Marcel Groen, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Marcel Groen is chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. We're joined in studio by our panel again, Donald Gilliland of the Trib, Dana Brown, Executive Director of Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics, Justin DePlato, Assistant Professor of Poli-Sci at Robert Morris. Any comments on what Mr. Groen said?
The thing you need to know about Marcel Groen is the reason he's in the job he is right now is because he did an extraordinary thing in Montgomery County. Montgomery County had been controlled by the Republican Party pretty much its entire existence. And Marcel, over the course of 15, 20 years, turned the county government from Republican to Democrat. And that's an extraordinary thing in Montgomery County. And they're hoping that they can do something similar on a statewide level. The problem is that Pennsylvania demographically is skewing older and Republican. So he's going to have a real challenge on his hands. But the other interesting thing I'd add is that when you look at this election, although traditionally blue counties went red for the president, they stayed blue for the row offices.
Dana.
Yeah, one thing that I want to mention about that is obviously in Pennsylvania, we had two women at the top of the ticket that lost Pennsylvania, right? So on the Democratic Party, we had Katie McGinty and Hillary Clinton. And yet the Democrats did end up sweeping those row offices with Democratic men. And so it's a little bit curious to those of us who study women in politics about what really why that was. Was it really a party issue? What role did gender play in that? And so I think that in thinking about Pennsylvania growing or changing, those row offices actually indicate to me that perhaps some of those rural folks or working class folks, they're up for grabs, their vote. And so if I'm the Democratic Party, I'm definitely reaching out to them and I'm not necessarily giving up. You know, I grew up in a union household, and I can tell you that a number of folks that my father knows went back and forth between like Trump and Obama. And I think that they're looking in the next 4 years, you know, what can a Trump-Pence ticket do for me? And if not, then maybe the Democrats can go back and grab that vote.
Justin.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would remind us, sort of down ballot voting turnout tends to fall off. So it's not surprising that the majority party did better on the down ballot races. And I would also remind us that gerrymandering is unconstitutional, and parties tend to complain about it when they lose elections. And when they win elections, nobody seems to talk about it. So,
well, you can go gerrymandering, but some of these districts look awfully strange looking, where you could say, why isn't there basically a square of X number of voters?
Right. And
why is it stretched over several counties?
Right. And the use of computer modeling and other techniques to try to handle the distribution problem is very complicated. But if the chairman actually thought gerrymandering is occurring, he could file a lawsuit and challenge that in court. So there is a remedy to that problem if he thinks it's so serious here in Pennsylvania.
I wanted to get your reaction to something that Congressman Doyle said prior to Chairman Groen. Do you anticipate much bipartisanship? Because there is, although Donald Trump has a Republican House and Senate, even during the transition, during the election, he wasn't always agreeing with the Republican leaders and Republican rank and file. So is he going to need much help from the Democrats in either chamber?
Yeah, I would absolutely say yes. And I think what most people are not realizing is that Donald Trump's biggest challenge will come from the Republican Party, in particular the House Freedom Caucus that really wants to balance
budgets.
There's
about 40 of them or so?
About 40. Then you add the Liberty Caucus, the Tea Party Caucus, you get closer to 75, 100 members who are adamant about cutting taxes but also balancing the budget. And the Trump administration is clearly coming from a more populist, progressive economic position that is not going to balance the budget, will cut taxes, but will spend at a very high rate. And so that will be a serious challenge for the administration. But the reality is Democrats will come on board to support infrastructure and other major spending incentives because, as we heard from the mayor and other Democrats, they want things built in their cities and their districts. So expect bipartisanship in an unusual way, and expect, again, the far right to be, I think, belligerent to the president.
What do you see about the chances for bipartisanship, Dana?
No, I definitely imagine that infrastructure in particular, that we're going to find some common ground there on the Republican, you know.
And Congressman Doyle even mentioned there could be common ground on Social Security and Medicare as well.
Right, because certainly Speaker Ryan has come out with an agenda that is perhaps not as supportive of those Social Security measures we know. So I definitely, it's going to be an interesting time because we don't really know what to expect. I mean, Donald Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail has been a little bit all over the place. And that's all we have because he does not have a governing record, unlike his colleagues in the House and the Senate, where we kind of we do know about the Freedom Caucus. Right. And so we know where they're going to want to go. So, you know, in the Donald Trump style, where will there be deals on the table? Will they be able to find even in the GOP area? We'll wait and see. But certainly, yeah, right at the top, we can name a couple things where I think Democrats will actually be supportive.
Don, quickly before we get to our next guest.
I think Dana's right in the sense that there's a great deal of uncertainty with where Trump really stands. All we know at the moment, for the most part, on policy issues can be found in tweets.
Okay. We'll have our panel back throughout this hour. You're listening to a special edition of The Confluence on 90.5 WESA, where the news comes together, an Inauguration Day special. Let's check in with an area of the state that is usually good to Democrats, going back to the long-serving Congressman John Murtha. We're talking about the Johnstown area and beyond. And we're joined now by Dave Suter, reporter for the Tribune Democrat. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
I am well, sir. Dave, in your reporting during the campaign and since the election, you've talked about fears amongst citizens, amongst voters. Fears of what?
Concern, you know, kind of basic thing. If you're uncertain about your employment, your job, having money to come in to take care of your family and your needs, then that puts a lot of concern in your life and kind of impacts everything, how you view in the world and political issues. And I think there was just a strong root of that in Johnstown, because there's been a lot of uncertainty over the last few decades with the steel mills closing and all the ripple effects that go with that. And it's just kind of been under the surface, or well, not even under the surface, kind of been prevalent for a while, and just showed through that people have a lot of concerns like that and showed up in this election.
You say Donald Trump tapped into the angst. How did he do that?
Yeah, he kept his message simple that really appealed to people around here. Bring back manufacturing, you know, get the coal mines going again, concerns about immigration, national defense. Just kept the basic simple messages that appeal to blue-collar voters in towns like Johnstown.
As you looked deeply inside the numbers, we're talking about going red this time, were you even surprised about maybe some of the changes? 2 out of 3 voters, I believe, in Cambria County went Trump. 3 out of 4 in Somerset County went Trump. 4 out of 5 in Bedford County. How does this compare with past elections?
Bedford and Somerset were traditionally red Republican, would go that way. Cambria has been, you know, it was an old union town. That's where a lot of the Democratic support came from. But there was always a clash with, say, modern Democratic Party stances on things like abortion, gun rights, and then climate change, you know, when you look at the coal and the debate that goes back and forth that. So in recent years, there's been kind of a conflict. So that really didn't surprise me that finally I think they were just kind of fed up the sense also that the National Democratic Party isn't bringing a message to voters in places like Johnstown that they're in line with, that they approve on, you know, the social issues and things like that. And I think it just finally, you know, finally flipped.
Final question, Dave. What's the atmosphere in Johnstown, the Johnstown area now? Is there anticipation, excitement, wait and see what when it comes to the new administration?
A little of everything. You know, I'm not based so much on road signs, but boy, we're leading up the election here. Trump signs wherever we were, hardly any Clinton signs. President-elect had a rally with about 6,000 people here. So there's a lot of excitement, but you got to produce. You know, if 4 years, if there's not an uptick in the jobs, and again, how people feel, if they feel secure or not in their existence, then, yeah, you get back to the voting booth and, you know, see if they're looking for a change again.
Dave Suter, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
Dave Suter is a reporter for the Johnstown Tribune Democrat. Let's now go to Washington, D.C., where WESA reporter Margaret Krause is there, and she's with a group of folks from Erie. Hello, Margaret.
Good morning, Kevin.
Margaret, Erie County turned out to be quite important for Donald Trump's win in PA. You're with a group of folks from Erie. As you've researched and spoken with folks from Erie and Erie County, what was the difference this time around?
I think the primary concern about the economy. In 2012, President Obama took Erie County by 16 points. This cycle, President-elect Trump took it by 2, and a lot of that can be attributed to worry about employment, which unemployment increased in Erie County this year.
And what is the atmosphere that you've experienced? Is it, I asked Dave Suter, you know, is it okay, wait and see, or is there excitement among the Trump supporters from Erie?
I think it's excitement. I think, you know, they're aware that one person can't change everything in 90 days or even, you know, the first year. But it seems like there's excitement here among supporters.
Margaret, I believe you're standing by with Phil and Marianne Spotts. May we talk with one of them, please?
Absolutely. I'm going to hand you off to Phil Spotts.
Hello, Phil. This is Kevin Gavitt. Whoop. Well, we lost her. Phil Spotts and Marianne Spotts traveled to Washington with their granddaughter, a 17-year-old, who I understand was, Margaret tells me, was active in the campaign, even though that she could not vote on that. So let's get back to our panel right now. I wanted to bring in, since I mentioned to Dave Suter and I asked Margaret as well, all right, the election's over. Is there the anticipation? Donald Trump goes into this election, goes into the White House with a much lower favorable rating than any of his predecessors. We're going to get back to the panel. We understand we have Margaret back on the line with Phil Spatz. Is that correct?
Here's Phil Spatz.
All right. Phil, very quickly, were you Trump supporters all along, or did you support someone else during the Republican primary process?
Well, when we first started, we were interested in supporting either Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz.
So,
but being they weren't successful in getting the nomination.
So was it obvious for you that you would go for the Republican nominee, or did you have to do some thinking about that?
Well, it wasn't a given decision. We had to do some thinking and praying about it, but we ended up supporting. We couldn't support some of the positions that the opposition was holding as far as abortion, things like that. But we definitely are behind the new president, and I think we're going to have a very successful 4 years.
Understand that you've traveled to Washington with your granddaughter, Allie. May we speak with her, please?
Yes, certainly, certainly.
Hello, Allie.
Hello.
So, Allie, you're 17, correct?
Yes, I am.
I'm told by our reporter, Margaret Krause, you were quite active in the political campaign. Why so when you couldn't even vote in the election?
Because I believe in starting the process early, and eventually I am going to be able to vote, and I want to be educated before that to prepare myself to make decisions in the future.
What do you expect to get out of the festivities of the inauguration that will help formulate your interest in politics in the future?
I expect to get excitement and hope, and it's already so exciting. The atmosphere is great, and you feel a sense of togetherness. It's a great opportunity to be here.
All right, Allie, thank you so much. Allie Skinner is with her grandparents in Washington. They're from Erie. And thanks to WESA reporter Margaret J. Krause as well. So let us now get to our panel. We talked a few things about changing Pennsylvania, about Erie, about Johnstown being traditionally Democrat, but some of the surrounding counties being Republican. But the margin for Donald Trump for the Republican nominee this time was much more than past Republican nominees at the presidential level. Do you see each of you that Pennsylvania is changing, evolving, or not? Let's go right down the line. Justin.
I would say it's not changing. We know the turnout was high in the rural suburban counties. We know the working class shifted as a function of economic populism of Trump's rhetoric. I often remind people that Indiana went for President Obama in 2008 and then swept back to the Republicans in 2012 and reelected now Vice President Pence. So this might just be a deviation. It might be an aberration. We'll see, depending on how popular and how successful Trump is. But clearly, there was an influx of a new wave of voters that has transformed Pennsylvania. Rather, I think many deviated from their normal voting tendencies.
All right. Dana, new voters, changing voters, aberration. It depends on what election it is. What do you think?
As I mentioned earlier, I do think, in particular, the working class vote, I think it is up for grabs. And I think, we used to call them Reagan Democrats, and now maybe some are Trump Democrats. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily see this really changing a great deal. I also want to remind folks, too, Trump didn't win Pennsylvania by a really large, large margin. I think it was 63,000 votes. So I definitely, to me, that's a pretty marginal number. And I know from working on a college campus, I can tell you that a lot of young people actually felt that they had the they could afford as Democrats to vote for third parties and do some other things because the poll numbers were so strong for Hillary Clinton. And so I'm wondering, if that impacted particularly like the millennial generation. I again, just from speaking on a college campus, there did seem to be that that kind of sentiment. So I definitely do not see a huge change across Pennsylvania. So if you're a Democrat, I wouldn't necessarily be completely worried about your state. But then also on the same time, you know, if you're a Republican, I wouldn't sit back and say, oh, we won this time. The state is absolutely changing. I would definitely be very vigilant if I'm a Republican right now.
Donald Gilman.
Yeah. And in this, for the case of accuracy, the 63,000 vote margin with which Trump won, that's an unofficial total that I tallied the morning after the election. It may be a bit higher than that, but not a huge amount. And the interesting thing about that is three quarters of that number is attributable to just four counties. One quarter is higher turnout overall, but three quarters is massive shifts in Luzerne, Lackawanna, Northampton, and Erie. And that's essentially Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Bethlehem, and Erie. And it's shifts from Obama to Trump in those four places that gave Trump the election. That said, I think Democrats do need to be worried because if going forward, looking at demographics, 10, 15 years out, Pennsylvania is becoming an older, redder state. And I think you're going to have a greater challenge going forward if you're a Democrat.
It's a special edition of The Confluence on this inauguration day. In the studio with us, we have, well, you just heard him, Donald Gilliland, digital editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Dana Brown, executive director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics. Justin DePlato, assistant professor of political science at Robert Morris University. Pittsburghers are in Washington to celebrate, to protest, to find out what some Pittsburghers who aren't traveling to D.C. are doing. The Confluence's producer, Marcus Charleston, went downtown.
I don't even want to give any time or energy to somebody who really ran on a platform that my community is burnt out and in horrible condition, and that somehow through some magic, all of a sudden they're going to be better.
I'm going to watch it just so that I can be disappointed, I guess. But yeah, I do plan to watch it.
I'm planning on seeing a friend over in Ohio. I guess it's not on my priority list.
I probably won't watch it. I am going down the next day to the march, the Women's March.
No, I don't plan on watching the inauguration. I'll be at work.
I'll be at work that day, so there won't be much opportunity for me to do that. But otherwise, you know, I would probably pay attention. It's an important event.
Well, we know about 200, nearly 200 Pittsburgh area residents are in Washington for the inauguration. They are members of the Franklin Regional High School Band, the only high school band from Pennsylvania in the parade. And we caught up with the band director, Kevin Pollock, who said he wasn't thinking about the politics of the event.
I was actually putting all this together starting in late September and through the month of October prior to the election. But that included a video of the band, pictures of the band, a resume of the band, and a couple letters of recommendation. I know our resume looks pretty good. These kids have done a lot in the last few years. I'd like to think that had a lot to do with us being asked to go. The kids are excited about it. I'm excited for them because a lot of them have done the Rose Parade, and now they're getting a chance to do a presidential inaugural, and they'll be talking about this to their own kids for years to come, I'm sure. It's certainly not, you know, an endorsement of any particular candidate or party. I looked at it as I was submitting these application materials as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for these kids.
That's band director Kevin Pollock of Franklin Regional High School. He says the trip was not mandatory. He said he had about five or six students opting out. Speaking of students, among the many, many, many journalists in Washington to cover the inauguration are a dozen young journalists from Point Park University. Among them, joining us now, is the general manager of Point Park student radio station, Vince Farinola. Welcome, Vince.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So, Vince, what are your expectations of what you're going to get out of this experience as a journalist?
As a journalist team, we really hope to bring all the Point Park medias together to cover this inauguration. The Obama inauguration was about 1.8 million people, and they're expecting about half of that here. We really want to make sure that we collaborate as three media outlets, that being WPPJ Radio, UView, our television station, and The Globe, our campus newspaper. And we want to bring coverage back that other schools and even media outlets around Pittsburgh couldn't cover. So we're happy to have a dozen students down here, and we're very thankful for this opportunity.
And you are sort of beginning your careers as journalists are wondering, are there going to be changes, especially in relationship with the administration? So it must be an exciting time.
Yes, it's a very exciting time. Although some of us feel that the landscape is changing in ways that might not be positive for journalism, we are excited to see what that may bring for us. And those challenges excite the students at Point Park.
Vince Farinola is general manager of Point Park University student radio station and is among a group of 12 Point Park journalists covering the inauguration. Vince, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Washington will also be the hub of activity tomorrow as women and men from the Pittsburgh area across Pennsylvania and throughout the nation participate in the Women's March. 90.5 WESA digital editor and reporter Megan Harris will be covering the event and joins us now. Hello, Megan.
Hey, Kevin.
Megan, I understand some of the marchers are with you. As you've started your research for this story and covering it, what have you uncovered? What have you found out?
I don't know that there were any big surprises. You know, this event has been covered nationally, you know, kind of from the beginning, from the moment we found out the election results. They're expected, you know, up to maybe a half a million women, all of them marching in solidarity against a president that they don't feel reflect the values that they hold dear.
I understand beside you is Heather Arnay, Executive Director of the Women and Girls Foundation of Western Pennsylvania. May we speak with Heather, please?
Yeah, of course. Here you go.
Heather Arnay, it's Kevin Gavin. What is the message you hope to deliver? And based on your anticipation, will it be heard or even acted upon? What are your hopes?
Well, I think for most of the people who are going to D.C. and marching today and tomorrow, I think mostly what everyone's message is that we won't stand back while this new president-elect might attempt to take our human rights or civil rights away. So whether folks are going to be marching around immigration reform or to protect our students who are dream students who are being threatened with being deported out of our country, whether it's around reproductive rights or LGBTQ rights or racial justice or criminal justice. You know, President Obama did a lot of work to protect and advance civil rights and human rights. And I think what you're going to see over the next 2 days is a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people marching to say we're going to resist any attempts to roll back our rights.
Heather, real quickly, is the message the same? Is it a unified message of the marchers, or is the message vary based on the intersection of characteristics, not just gender, but race, ethnicity, sexual identity, income status?
Well, the Women's March in D.C. has an official platform, which is incredibly robust and inclusive, and a lot of different organizations and individuals work to create that platform. But again, I think what you're really going to hear and what is a unified message is that at the core, what people are talking about is their human rights and their civil rights and their rights to collectively bargain. And, you know, we aren't going to let somebody just come into D.C. and easily take away those rights. I think what you're going to hear is resistance, and you're going to hear that nobody is giving up their human rights or civil rights in this country without a fight.
Heather Arnay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's rejoin our panel right now and wrap up the discussion on this Inauguration Day special, the Confluence. So what are your anticipations for the first 100 days, first couple years for this first term of President Donald Trump? All right, Dana Brown.
Sure, I'd love to go first.
You were pointed at.
I think I was voluntold to the listening audience there. So this is wholly unsatisfactory. I understand what I'm about to say is just not very exciting. But again, because a President Trump does not have a governing record, it is incredibly difficult to say, with any kind of clarity what really we expect. And so, in particular with the GOP Congress, with those fissures that Justin had articulated earlier. So that's not entirely clear, but certainly he's signaling a pretty conservative agenda with the nominations to date. So I think that if his nominations are an indicator, then certainly we would expect some rollback in environmental regulations. We would expect perhaps a very different type of foreign policy, one that could perhaps be described as more isolationist. You know, we've always really, or in the last 100 years, America has taken a pretty I would say proactive approach in our foreign policy, and so Donald Trump has signaled potentially with a change in that. Although again, with a secretary, Tillerson, again without a governing record, it's actually really difficult. But we can just anticipate. So that might be unsatisfactory.
No, I think you're right, and I think one of the things that we're going to see is a continuation of something that we've seen during the campaign. And I know some people will take some umbrage at this, but I think there's a difference between what you hear or what is said and what is done. I think you're going to be hearing a lot of the same rhetoric from the incoming president. But if you look at particularly his candidates for Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State and James Mattis for Secretary of Defense, their testimony during their hearings was diametrically opposed to the supposed policy that Trump campaigned on. So I think you're going to see a bit of a friction there, and I think you may have Trump saying one thing and the administration actually doing something a bit more traditional.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and to be somewhat of the contrarian, we can be somewhat timid about not knowing a lot about Trump and his policy positions, or we could be excited because ultimately it may be something new and fresh for the American people. I wrote an editorial sort of comparing Trump to the Whigs, and I think the idea of a genuine American system that Clay introduced many years ago is very similar to what Trump espouses, sort of economic populism and a pragmatic view on things. So I think one of the things to do is read The Art of the Deal, where he really does tell us who he is, and he's a deal maker. He throws a lot of things up in the air, and he hopes things stick. And ultimately, some might not like that as a governing philosophy, but, you know, that's Donald Trump for you. And in the end, it's going to be a spectacle, I think. There's no question about that, but we shouldn't be so depressed already before our president comes into office.
I think the thing that we can be depressed about is not so much coming from above, but I think some of the worst elements of our society have been invigorated. Just this past week, there was a truck in Johnstown that was celebrating the loving memory of James Earl Ray. And I think that's going to be a thing we have to look out for.
Well, folks, we're going to have to cut it at that. We thank you so very much, our panel. Donald Gilliland, Tribune Review digital editor, Dana Brown, executive director of Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics, and Justin DePlato, assistant professor of political science at Robert Morris University. Plus, thanks to all of our guests during this hour. And that'll do it for this special Inauguration Day edition of The Confluence, where the news comes together. Production assistance today from Chris Ayers and Katie Blackley, our engineer Tom Hurley. The producer for The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.